October is Breast Cancer Awareness Month, and breast cancer is the most common cancer among women apart from skin cancers. According to the National Breast Cancer Foundation, about 1 in 8 American women will experience breast cancer during their lives. Breast cancer is an incredibly difficult disease to fight or to watch a loved one go through. Raising awareness of the scope and seriousness of this disease is one of the most important and impactful functions of breast cancer events. Fundraising events, such as walks and fun runs, have become a common way to raise awareness about this issue and financially support the people and families who have been affected by breast cancer. Individuals, as well as nonprofit organizations like the Susan G. Komen Breast Cancer Foundation and BreastCancer.org, have taken it upon themselves to earn money for breast cancer research. One of the slogans often used during October Breast Cancer Awareness Month is "Breast cancer awareness is not just a month."
Welcome to Physicians Weekly.
Welcome to this episode of Physicians Weekly podcast. My name is Dr. Rachel Giles from Medical Medical Publishers in collaboration with Physicians Weekly. We have 3 fantastic in-depth interviews for you this week.
The Physicians Weekly podcast provides thought leader insights on the latest medical news, clinical trial coverage, and advances in medicine and healthcare.
Later in this podcast, Physicians Weekly senior editor Marta Kelly interviews Dr. John Barbieri, dermatologist at the Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, about the cardiovascular risk factors in patients with psoriasis and psoriatic arthritis. We know that patients with psoriasis and psoriatic arthritis have an increased risk for cardiovascular mortality, but are less likely to have traditional cardiovascular risk factors identified and managed. This is a major evidence to practice GAP. To improve the prevention of cardiovascular disease in patients with psoriatic disease, Dr. Barbieri lays out some pragmatic approaches for physicians. Also in this podcast, we're back again this week with Physicians Weekly's regular contributor, known by the pseudonym Dr. Medlaw. She's a board-certified radiologist and medical malpractice attorney. Today, she takes a deep dive in the doctor-patient privilege, what that means, when and how it can be used, and why it is important. Did you know that the patient privilege came about as a public health intervention to prevent the spread of venereal disease? But firstly, in honor of Breast Cancer Awareness Month, today we will kick off our podcast with an interview with Dr. Marco Timmers, the CEO of an up-and-coming pharmaceutical company, Beyondis, who presented their initial data from the Phase 3 TULIP trial in breast cancer patients during the Presidential Symposium of the European Society of Medical Oncology just a few weeks ago. Their new antibody conjugate drug, called trastuzumab duocarmazine, was compared to the physician's choice in the third-line setting in 436 metastatic HER2-positive breast cancer patients. The results showed impressive efficacy in the initial top-line results. Enjoy listening. So thank you, Dr. Timmers, for joining us, the CEO of Beyondis. Could you please tell us a little bit about the trial presentation that was held at ESMO last weekend?
Yes, thanks for the opportunity to discuss this today. It was a great presentation. I hope you saw it as well from Dr. Saura. What was really clear is that the field, the KOLs in the breast cancer field, really welcome new products. That was a clear signal that I picked up from the presentation. One of the new features in the metastatic breast cancer space, obviously, are ADCs, antibody drug conjugates. One that has been around for quite some time is, of course, Kadcyla, T-DM1. A more recent addition to that was Enhertu, which had indeed spectacular results in the metastatic breast cancer HER2-positive space. And, of course, CID-985, from which the results were presented yesterday. And I think the most important conclusion from the discussion is that new products with a new mode of action, a novel mechanistic way to kill the tumors, are really welcomed. Because patients with metastatic breast cancer, as you know, you cannot cure them. So after a therapy line, it is really welcomed that there is an additional HER2-targeting therapy available. And that is why we think that also CID-985 is adding something to the armament of the doctors that are treating those end-stage patients.
Thank you. And so the trial was designed to compare the trastuzumab duocarmazine to the physician's choice, correct? And that could have been many other options, right? There are capecitabine, I think, combinations available and so forth. Can you discuss how did that actually look? What was the comparator arm looking like?
So what we wanted to do is to create a comparison with a real-life situation. And that means that sometimes, depending on the pretreatment of a certain patient, a certain combination of a physician's choice therapy is generally used. And that can be inspired by the pretreatment. So not all patients have had the same pretreatment, which makes sense. And therefore, also the physician's choice options were four predefined combinations that are generally used. But of course, the final choice is inspired by the pretreatment that the patient had. And of course, the decision is then taken by the doctor in consultation with the patient. So from these four groups, we had roughly, well, they were not completely equally distributed, but roughly all of these different options were given in the control arm.
Excellent. And what did the safety profile look like?
Well, the safety profile of the physician's choice is the traditional safety profile. Of course, there's more hematological toxicity, so bone marrow toxicity, which is associated with the chemotherapy. And in, of course, the treatment arm with CYT985 or trastuzumab duocarmazine, the most prominent toxicity was eye toxicity. That, by the way, was quite well manageable by dose reductions and or dose delays. And if you compare, for example, the data from our phase 1 trial with the data that were obtained in our phase 3 trial, we allowed more dose reductions and more dose delays in the phase 3 trial in comparison with the phase 1 trial. And the good news is that that resulted in a lower incidence of particularly higher grade eye toxicities. So we are quite confident that in the end, in real practice, when doctors are even more free to play around with the dosing regimen than in a more rigid trial environment, we believe that that in clinical practice, the eye toxicity will become even more manageable. But we have to see how this evolves after approval.
And with regard to cardiotoxicities, any observed?
No, we have not seen any cardiotoxicity. To be honest, we were primed, of course, by the historical data from trastuzumab in combination with anthracyclines. That is, of course, a combination that may induce cardiotoxicity. So we have carefully monitored that in our phase 1 trial already, and we have not picked up any signal of cardiotoxicity. And of course, also in the phase 3 trial, this was subject of a close monitoring. But the good news here is that we have not seen any signs of serious cardiotoxicity, which is indeed a relief, because I agree with you, in those end-stage patients, this is something you want to avoid, but there's no sign of cardiac events induced by trastuzumab duocarmazine.
Great. So you've got this great data that's supporting the use of trastuzumab duocarmazine for the third line. What about other future combinations? Are you looking in the adjuvant space? Are you going to be looking at other combinations? And what are the next steps going forward?
Yeah, we are actually conducting a trial in the neoadjuvant setting in consultation with the I-SPY consortium in the United States. We are doing that not in the HER2-positive neoadjuvant patient group, but in the HER2-low-expressing group. And we do that because we believe there's a higher unmet need. And as you may appreciate, in our phase 1 trial, we've picked up quite a substantial signal of efficacy in HER2-low-expressing breast cancer patients. Like, for example, triple-negative breast cancer patients. And this is, of course, the rationale for conducting this trial in the HER2-low-expressing patients. We were approached by I-SPY to participate with CYT985 as a treatment arm in the ongoing I-SPY trial. And although we have not generated any results, of course, we're quite curious to see how CYT985 might be able to indeed reduce the pathological complete response rate. We are currently developing CYT985 also in other indications, like endometrial cancer. And we're also looking at other combinations with other drugs, for example, with a PARP inhibitor, niraparib. That trial is also ongoing, and I'm happy to say that we are quite close to finalizing the dose escalation part. And then we will move on with a tolerable dose combination in a couple of additional indications like ovarian cancer, endometrium cancer, and also triple negative breast cancer. So there's a lot ongoing with CYT985, and it's just the beginning with this potential approval in the third line HER2-positive metastatic breast cancer setting.
Wonderful. Thanks for taking the time to talk with us today.
Thank you.
For nearly 40 years, Physicians Weekly has been a trusted source of medical news and information for healthcare professionals.
I
morning. Today I'm here with Dr. John Barbieri. He is Associate Physician of Dermatology at Brigham and Women's Hospital and Instructor in Dermatology at Harvard Medical School. Good morning.
Hey, it's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. Today we're going to discuss a paper he wrote called Lifestyle Risk Factor Counseling at Visits for Psoriasis and Psoriatic Arthritis in the United States. This was recently published in the Journal of the American Academy of Dermatology. What makes this topic an important one to study? What needs existed for your research, Dr. Barbieri?
So patients with psoriasis are at an increased risk of cardiovascular disease. In fact, patients with psoriasis die several years younger than patients without psoriasis after controlling for other traditional risk factors like smoking, diabetes, high blood pressure, high cholesterol. And so managing and preventing cardiovascular disease among patients with psoriasis is incredibly important. However, some of the work that we've done has found that among patients with psoriasis, only about 20% of them have an active relationship with a primary care provider. And so it's important for us as physicians, including specialists like dermatologists and rheumatologists, to think about how we can prevent cardiovascular disease among patients with psoriasis and psoriatic arthritis. And so that got us interested in looking at whether in visits among both non-dermatologists, like primary care doctors and rheumatologists, and among dermatologists, whether there's counseling for common risk factors that can increase the risk of cardiovascular disease, like smoking, like patients who are overweight or obese. And so that was what drove the conduct of this study.
Can you briefly explain what you and your colleagues set out to determine with the study and how you went about conducting it?
So we used a large nationally representative cross-sectional database called the National Ambulatory Medical Care Survey, or NAMPS. And what this database includes is they go to clinician offices, so all kinds of doctors around the country, and they kind of follow them around for a week and see what kinds of patients they see and what happens in those visits. And they put that together into a large database that has population survey metrics so that you can estimate for the entire US population what types of visits are happening and what's happening at those visits. So in this database, we identified patients who had psoriasis and psoriatic arthritis, patients who saw both dermatologists and non-dermatologists. And then we went and we looked at these visits. How often do patients who are listed as smokers get counseling about tobacco use? Or patients who are overweight or obese get counseling about obesity? Or patients in general just get counseling about any modifiable risk factors like diet and exercise, obesity, or smoking together?
What findings from your study are important to stress to our physician readers, particularly dermatologists and primary care physicians?
Yeah, so maybe not surprisingly, but also maybe not what one would hope, we found that this kind of counseling is uncommon, both at visits to dermatologists and non-dermatologists. For instance, counseling about tobacco use among smokers occurred at only 7% of visits with non-dermatologists and 1% of visits with dermatologists. Counseling about obesity among patients who are overweight or obese occurred at 6% of visits with non-dermatologists and almost no visits with dermatologists. And any counseling at all among visits for psoriasis and psoriatic arthritis, for diet and exercise, smoking, or obesity occurred at only 20% of encounters with non-dermatologists and 1% overall encounters with dermatologists. And while these numbers might be an underestimate just based on some of the limitations of this data set, it certainly highlights that there's likely room for us to improve the counseling that we're doing for these patients who we know are at higher risk of cardiovascular disease.
What are the implications of your research? How would you like to see physicians, again, particularly dermatologists and primary care physicians, incorporate your findings into their practices?
I think there's a several-fold types of interventions that are needed. So first, we need just better education, both among patients and among clinicians, about the risk of cardiovascular disease in patients with psoriasis, so that patients and their clinicians are aware about the need to address these issues. In addition, as I mentioned earlier, dermatologists are and rheumatologists sometimes are the main clinician that patients are seeing them. Some of them may not have a primary care provider at all, or may not see that clinician regularly. And so there may be an opportunity for dermatologists and rheumatologists to be more involved in this kind of counseling. And as our work shows, they're currently not very involved at all. And so there may be an opportunity to engage there more with their patients.
And finally, what would you like to see future research focus on in this area? What needs still exist?
So this is just one study. And this data set does have some limitations. There's a, you know, some potential where patients who get some form of counseling might not be captured. This is a cross-sectional data set. It doesn't look at patients over time. So there may be patients who got counseled at one visit and not at a different visit, and we're not capturing that. So this data is likely an underestimate of the true degree of counseling. So we do need other studies using different techniques that can try to address some of the weaknesses of this study. And more importantly, we need to think about how we can prevent cardiovascular disease among this population where it's incredibly important. What are the ways that we can use collaborative care models where we engage dermatologists and rheumatologist specialists who manage the skin and joint disease associated with psoriasis and other clinicians like cardiologists and primary care providers to be able to optimize cardiovascular risk prevention among this population?
Well, thank you very much for participating today.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Physicians Weekly is back again with our regular contributor, Dr. Medlaw, a board-certified radiologist and medical malpractice attorney, this time to discuss the patient privilege. Dr. Medlaw, thank you for joining us today.
Pleasure to be here.
Doctors know that the communications within the special relationship with their patients have many protections, but are often not sure about how these function. What do you think?
Well, the thing to understand about patient privacy is there are different ways that the release of medical information can be gated. Now, all doctors know the basic idea that they are ethically responsible to keep their patients' medical information private. It's actually in the Hippocratic Oath. It goes back that far. Then there are common law and statutory limitations, and the most famous statutory limitation is HIPAA. And those cover when and how a release of information can be done. And there's also the doctor-patient privilege. And that allows the patient to essentially close the doctor's mouth, preventing not just a release of records, but testimony as well, in both civil and criminal cases. You know, privileges are bars to finding the truth. They frustrate the process because they allow the person who holds the privilege to prevent someone with knowledge of the facts, perhaps really critical knowledge, from revealing those facts. The answer to why we grant some communications this status anyway is that there are some societal interests that are considered so important that the law gives them extra protection. The ability of a penitent person to confess to a clergy member or spouses to speak honestly with each other in private are examples of those. And so is the therapeutic interaction between a doctor and a patient. We want to favor frank and open communication so that doctors can have access to the information that they need to treat their patients effectively. This privilege was actually originally a public health issue related to venereal disease. The goal was that patients not be so ashamed to tell their doctors something embarrassing and something that could be used against them in a proceeding like a divorce, that they wouldn't get treated and then would spread the infection further. However, it now applies to all medical care. Now, all privileged material is confidential, but not all confidential material is privileged. Although the concept of ethical medical confidentiality goes back to ancient Greece, there's no privilege at common law. And that's because it's not a law of confidentiality. It's a law of evidence. It was therefore created by statute on a state-to-state basis, and different states may treat it widely or narrowly, may extend it as well to non-physician practitioners, and may also vary its application between civil and criminal cases. There's also no general doctor-patient privilege in federal court. There's just a limited one for psychotherapists. Now, there are superficial similarities between confidentiality and privilege because the patient holds the privilege, just as the patient is the one who determines who can have their PHI under confidentiality law, and only the patient can waive either one. But confidentiality, whether under a state statute or HIPAA, is a general matter, while privilege only applies to legal proceedings. So in summary, then, while states, through their own confidentiality laws and the federal government under HIPAA, follow the classic ethical approach of the doctor being responsible to guard the patient's private health information, Different states have decided to what extent they will let a patient actually block a doctor from giving needed information in a legal proceeding.
What criteria must be met for the privilege to apply?
Well, first, and obviously, there has to have been a physician-patient relationship at the time of the communication with the doctor. And then only information actually needed for medical care can be shielded. Give you an example from New York. The statute there says that it applies to information that a practitioner acquired in attending a patient in a professional capacity and which was necessary to enable them to act in that capacity. What that means is that extraneous facts are not privileged, even if they're part of the same statement. So let's look at a for instance. Suppose someone comes into the ER with a large scalp laceration and tells the doctor, "My neighbor hit me with a bat when he caught me trying to steal his TV." Well, that the injury was due to being hit with a bat can be privileged because the doctor needs it to determine proper medical care, because blunt trauma gets a different assessment than a laceration due to a sharp object. However, the part of the statement that relates to having attempted that robbery, it's irrelevant to medical care, and so it's not shieldable. And it's fully admissible later at trial through the doctor's testimony, even if the patient, who's now a defendant, objects. The communication with the doctor must also have been made in the expectation of privacy and by the patient. So it must have been made in a way that the doctor or someone acting as their direct agent, you know, like their MA, would see or hear. So speaking in an examination room while the door is open in a busy office, or leaving a message on a doctor's home phone that other family members could have access to, that would defeat the privilege. A statement made to a doctor in the presence of hospital staff would also not be privileged, because even if they are working with the doctor, they are agents of the hospital, not the doctor. One exception, though, could be a translator, because they're acting solely as a facilitator of the communication and so would not be considered a third party. And that could differ between states. The presence of a third person who is a spouse or a parent of the patient is also going to defeat the privilege from vesting, because just like a stranger being there would do, their presence ends any expectation by the patient that what was revealed will just be between themselves and the doctor.
So, if the privilege does apply, is it absolute? Meaning that the patient can block any private exchange about their treatment with the doctor?
No, it is not absolute. Doctor-patient privilege can be limited by public safety statutes, such as those that mandate the reporting of sexually transmitted diseases, or by regulations for cooperation with law enforcement. Such as those that mandate the reporting of gunshot wounds or elder or child abuse, and by duty to report laws such as Tarasoff laws and requirements to inform the state if a patient is unsafe to drive. As we talked about earlier in the Holmes case, it can also be a statutory waiver of the privilege when a plea is entered based on that privileged information. You can't have both. You can't say the information is the basis of my plea, but don't talk about it. Medical boards can, as a matter of professional regulation, also access patient records that might otherwise be subject to privilege. For example, there was a case of a doctor who was being investigated for endangering patients by her, shall we say, unorthodox methods. And she asserted privilege as to her records, and so did some of her patients who were very loyal to her, and the answer from the board was no. Responding to a valid subpoena can also take material out of privilege protection. However, in this regard, it is really essential to remember that not all subpoenas are created equal. Papers that just come from a lawyer's office and they're threatening contempt, they're not enforceable on that. If the doctor believes that there's a clear conflict with privilege, they should assert that. The side that wants the information then can seek an order or a subpoena from an actual judge. Now, talking about the role of judges, the doctor-patient privilege can also be overridden by a judge's order during a case. The side that wants the information or testimony will make a demand, and the doctor will then assert the privilege. And you've probably seen this in a lot of cases on Law and Order. The side that wants the information or testimony will then make a motion to compel. The side opposing production then will make a motion to suppress. And then the judge, and this is the part that you see on TV, will question the doctor and inspect the records in camera, you know, privately in their chambers off the record. And the judge will also hear arguments from both sides. And the thing to remember is that in all of these settings, a permissible release of material that would otherwise be privileged then protects the doctor from liability for revealing facts about the patient's treatment or condition.
How about in a malpractice case? Hasn't the patient waived the privilege by bringing the case in public?
A plaintiff in a malpractice action wants the medical records to be in evidence and for the doctor to testify about them because they believe that they will thereby prove their case. They therefore execute authorizations for the release of their records, waiving confidentiality generally and waiving the privilege where it would apply. The problem comes up when a plaintiff wants to cherry pick what is released. In that situation, a court in New York summarized the fairness issue very nicely. And what it said was, a party should not be permitted to assert a mental or physical condition in seeking damages or in seeking to absolve himself from liability, and at the same time assert the privilege in order to prevent the other party from ascertaining the truth of the claim and the nature and extent of the injury or condition. So again, as we talked about with waivers, you can't have it both ways. There is therefore going to be an implied waiver of privilege in specifically putting your own condition at issue. However, this is the law, so it's never going to be completely uncomplicated. And the problem is how far that goes.
What happens if the doctor actually reveals what should have been privileged?
If the doctor did not yet testify or produce records, the patient would bring a motion to prevent them from doing so. If the information is already out there, then the patient can make a motion to suppress it, to exclude the evidence that the doctor provided. And this is the part the doctors care about. The patient can also sue the doctor and can make a complaint to the state medical board about the privilege breach. And remember that when you make a complaint to the state medical board, you don't even have to prove that you were damaged. It's the misconduct itself that is disciplined. So in other words, take privilege seriously and don't talk or act until you are sure that you can.
As always, Dr. Medlaw, thank you for joining us today.
And thanks for another opportunity to talk about an important issue.
That's all the time we have for this week's podcast. Thanks for listening. I hope you learned something new. Stay safe and stay healthy.
Stay tuned for our next episode as we are joined by top thought leaders to discuss the latest groundbreaking research presented at this month's top annual medical meeting.